Let's get started. Welcome everyone back to Breakfast in the Bay. So good to see so many people. I'm talking fast already. So good to see so many people in person. So we do have a bit more of a limited time this morning. So we are going to have to go a little bit quicker, but I will continue to speak a little bit slower, hopefully, at the same time. So let's spend some time speaking about the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen Kagan. So anyone know his actual last name? Pupko. His last name was Pupko. Right? So if you know any Pupkos, they're more likely sometimes related to the Chafetz Chaim family than the Kagan people. Kagan people are. I do know a few Kagans as well. So it could be that there's some. Oh, you need more source sheets. Okay, a second. I'm gonna print out two more source sheets in the printer. Okay. Okay. So that was his name, and so yeah, if you see Pupkos, they're more likely related to the Chafetz Chaim than the Kagans are. But nonetheless, Kagan Pupko, they mean the same thing. It means that you're a Kohen. So the Chafetz Chaim, he was born in a town called Zettel in Poland in 1839, March time. I don't know the exact English date, but the Hebrew date was the 11th of Shvat. His parents were Rabbi Aryeh Zev HaKohen, and Dabrusha was his mother. His father was a very well-known man in town. He was a shopkeeper of sorts, very respected, very kind of sought after, just for being a role model of how he went about his business and how he interacted with other people. It's interesting, before we begin talking about the Chafetz Chaim, and we're going to begin to get into it now, just to preempt that by saying that when it comes to the Chafetz Chaim and understanding who he was one of the biggest, the Gedolei Hador in the last 100 years or so, but that's an understatement. The level at which he was respected and sought after and appreciated, not just for his knowledge of Torah, but also just for being an incredibly special and sweet person. There's no other word for it. Just someone who was so kind to others and respectful to others. Someone who had such integrity. You'll be hard out to find anyone in human history over the last couple hundred years that was of that level, right? Sometimes you do find a great Gedolei Hador that are, forgive me for saying this, could appear aloof and out of touch and, you know, aren't so approachable. He was just known for his absolute kindness and for his care of every other person. So just to share two stories before we actually begin talking about him. So the first is, take a look at page number one to intro source one. So this is a pretty well-known story about the Chafetz Chaim and his humility. He was always denying that he was as great as people saw him to be. So take a look inside. There's several versions of this story, but let's see this one. It is told that when he was once riding in a train, he was noticed by another Jewish traveler. The traveler noticed him, a small Jew, right? So the Chafetz Chaim was known as being very, very relatively short. So he was a small Jew sitting in a corner of the railway coach, hunched forward and half asleep. The traveler moved closer and in a booming voice began with the usual greeting, Shalom Aleichem, right? Where does a Jew like you come from? So he says, from the Vilna province. He says, from which town near Vilna? Oh, from a small town near Lida. So the Jewish traveler persisted. Which town is that? He says, Radin. He came from a town called Radin. And so the person responds to him, Radin, everyone knows that the Chafetz Chaim lived in the city of Radin. He says, you must know the Chafetz Chaim, how special and how lucky you are. You have a great tzaddik that lives in your town. The small Jew from Radin shook his head. A tzaddik? That's news to me. He's a plain Jew like all of the Jews. The traveler cannot bear this. Would you listen to such impudence from a Jew? To insult the Chafetz Chaim? You should be ashamed of yourself. How can an old man like you allow himself to disparage his honor when the whole world agrees that he is a tzaddik of our generation? The small Jew was unmoved. He mumbled as though to himself, not true, I know. I am acquainted with him. He is not a tzaddik at all. The traveler grew angrier and hurled invective at the small Jew. Meanwhile, the train came to a halt at a station and new passengers came on. They recognized the Chafetz Chaim immediately and came over to greet him with great deference. So, right, this little man was the Chafetz Chaim. The person was speaking to the Chafetz Chaim and he didn't realize it was the Chafetz Chaim. Long story short, he was always denying that he was so great, even towards the end of his life, when people would stand up for him and people would, from the world around, see him as and treat him as this Gadol Hador. He had no idea what people were doing. He had no idea what that was about. He genuinely just thought of himself as a small little Jew from the town of Radin. Radin was a very small town. And so he just saw, this is a small town. I'm a small, simple Jew. That's it. And he never was able to move such a mentality because that's just how he always saw himself. To another introductory story to put ourselves in the mindset of who the Chafetz Chaim was. Take a look at intro source number 2 on page 1 still. It says, one day the Chafetz Chaim was walking on a street in Vilna with his son-in-law Rav Hirsch Levinson when an indigent Jewish man came over and brushed away some dust from the sage's overcoat. When the Chafetz Chaim realized what the man had done, he began looking around in an attempt to find the man and reward him, but in vain, for the man had vanished. The Chafetz Chaim was in considerable distress for the rest of the way. He cannot bear to have someone put himself to trouble for him for nothing, right? So he wanted to give this guy a tip. It was so nice. He brushed off, this man came over to the Chafetz Chaim, he brushed off his jacket. So the Chafetz Chaim wanted to give him some money, pay him a couple of rubles, whatever it was, whatever it is. At the end of the walk, he and his son-in-law arrived at their place of lodging. Feeling in his overcoat pocket for a ruble note he had put there before setting out on the walk, he was surprised to find it was not there. In vain, he searched for it, unable to think where it could have gone. At that, Reb Hirsch remarked that the unknown poor man they had encountered on the street had probably taken the ruble when he brushed the dust from his coat, right? He wasn't being a mensch, he wasn't brushing him off. He was pickpocketing him, he was stealing from him. Hearing this conjecture, the Chafetz Chaim happily replied, in that case, we really have paid him for his trouble. So here you have a story where the Chafetz Chaim was pickpocketed, someone came over and stole money from him, and he was so grateful because he felt so bad that he couldn't pay the guy for apparently brushing off some dust from his overcoat. So he said, he was so happy that he stole money from him because he was compensated for all of his trouble. That's who the Chafetz Chaim was, an absolute humble person with no one that had greater integrity for him, and at the same time, an absolute gadol batorah, and clearly those were linked in his mind. To be such a great, humble person with integrity was also the same as being a gadol batorah in his mind. So, the Chafetz Chaim's early life, there's not very much known about it. We do know that, so he was born, as we said, in 1839. In 1849, his father passed away. Cholera was the big pandemic of those days, and so his father seemingly passed away in that pandemic. So he was mostly raised by his mother and cared for by his older half-brother, who's named Aaron, and his mother ultimately, a few years later, would end up remarrying to a man in the city, in the town of Radin, and that's how the family was ended up in Radin. So the Chafetz Chaim, even though his mother remarried, and seemingly he would be living with his mother and new stepfather, he spent most of his time learning in yeshiva in Vilna. He was befriended and taken under the wing of Rav Chaim Nachman Parnas, one of the great gedolim of that time. They say that the maskilim, right, the individuals who are part of the Enlightenment, the Jewish Enlightenment, that they always went after the young Jewish yeshiva boys who seemed to be up and coming and that they were going to be great. Because what better way to grab someone for the Jewish Enlightenment, to bring them off the derech a little bit, than to find the biggest iluyim, the biggest people who were probably going to be great Torah learners, to take them away and, you know, bring them into the Jewish Enlightenment. So the Chafetz Chaim evidently was a sought-after suspect, and they kept trying to get him to speak in other things other than Torah, whatever, and the story goes is that finally, after enough prodding, the Chafetz Chaim responded to these guys, and he, at the age of 10 or 11, was able to outwit these older maskilim, and basically just show how he could not be drawn away from a life of Torah. At the age of 16 in the year 1855, the Chafetz Chaim was engaged to be married. That was actually relatively young for those days. Many people would get married or engaged at around 13 or 14. So 16 was somewhat late for him. He was engaged to be married and ultimately married his stepsister. So his mother, as we said, married a new man after his father passed away. That man then had a whole series of children from his first wife, so he wasn't at all related to this young girl. But basically, the way the story goes is that the Chafetz Chaim's mother was adamant that he would not marry his stepsister, and the Chafetz Chaim's stepfather was adamant that he would marry his daughter, right? The Chafetz Chaim's stepsister. So supposedly, this led to such a great dispute within the family between this couple that they almost separated over this because it was so damaging for their relationship. But the Chafetz Chaim heard about this, he got wind, and he said, I can't allow a dispute about me cause a breakup between my mom and her husband, between my stepfather. So he said, when he got home and he spoke to his mother, he said, would you give your blessing to this marriage if I would agree to marry her? And ultimately she said yes, that she would agree to it, and so they were married. It's interesting to note that we mentioned that Aaron, his 9-year older brother, was one of the individuals who was involved in helping to raise the Chafetz Chaim when he was a young boy after his father had passed away. He was also very adamant against this marriage. I'm not entirely sure. I was not really able to find why there was such I think probably more the situation. It is interesting to note that she was older than him, so to have someone who's older, certainly in those days, was a little bit odd. But I think more the situation that the Chafetz Chaim, everyone knew at the age of 16 that he was going to be someone great, and someone who was great, it's usually married into wealth or married into a distinguished family. Not that his stepfather wasn't a distinguished person from a distinguished family, but he wasn't, you know, one of the well-known great people. No one's really ever heard of the father of the Chafetz Chaim, the stepfather of the Chafetz Chaim. So there was an expectation that he could, I guess, do better. And as such, everyone was upset about it. His brother supposedly didn't talk to him for a number of months or years after the event because he had wanted him not to get married to her, but he ultimately did. The way the story goes is that his half-brother was on his way to stop the Chafetz Chaim from marrying this girl or from doing the Tanayim with the girl, and on the way there he got into an accident or something and he couldn't make it there in time, so the Tanayim was signed and the Chafetz Chaim told his brother that this is actually a sign from Shemayim that clearly you were delayed and I was meant to marry her, and so that's the way the story goes. But he was really upset for a long time, but ultimately they made up. They were so therefore ultimately married in the winter of 1855, when the Chafetz Chaim was already 17 years old. They would have 4 children together, Reb Aryeh Leib, Gittel, Sarah, and Avraham. Those are the 4 children's names. Avraham, as we'll speak about it in just a little bit, his youngest son from the first wife, so he actually unfortunately passed away at a relatively young age, but we'll see that the Chafetz Chaim also ends up having 2 additional children with his second wife. We'll see that in just a little bit. So, throughout the Chafetz Chaim's early years, he was often pushed time and time again to be a community rabbi. Certainly back in those days, it was a great honor to be seen as the leader of the town, right? The community rabbi did not just have a shul, but they were the leader of the town. They were the posek of the town. So that was a very honored position. But he consistently and constantly refused and said, who am I? I'm just Yisrael Meir. I'm not worthy of being a rabbi of a town. He's also very known. The Chafetz Chaim was known, him and his family, throughout their lives. They were always very poor. He never wanted to take money from anyone. He was, like we said earlier, he had a lot of integrity. He never wanted to get any money that he himself did not earn and that he did not deserve. So he didn't have a lot of money. He, as we'll see, he had kind of small and meager jobs and ended up giving a lot of that money away. So he lived very poorly for his entire life. At the age of 20 in the year 1859, the Chafetz Chaim inherited 150 rubles from I don't know if she was estranged, but I don't know too much about her. He got 150 rubles from a sister of his father. I mean, he used those 150 rubles, which I guess was a lot of money, to buy a store. So he managed a store for a number of years. I'm trying to think if I want to... Well, we'll skip source number 1 for now, but source number 1 is related to this. We'll just say it sort of briefly outside. He bought the store, his wife ran the store, and he would come back to the store every now and again to take care of some of the ledgers and deal with some of help his wife out when the hours were a little bit busier in the store. And the way that they talk about it is that the reason why the store did not last very long was because since he was such a man of integrity and honesty, he was always concerned that he would be cheating someone and that he would accidentally take too much money or not give enough food or whatever it was. So he was always running after people, giving them their money back or some of their money back, a little more food, whatever it was, because he was always so concerned. He was always so worried that maybe someone would feel cheated or someone it would look like someone was cheated. And therefore, business was not really his acumen, and that did not last too long. So he spent a few years while he was this owner of this shop, he would learn very intensely and only help out every now and again when it was necessary. The Chavetz Chaim in 1865, after it was clear that the business world wasn't really working out so well, and even though he refused to become a rabbi of a community, he was willing to accept a position as a rabbi, not as the rabbi of a community, but as a Rosh Yeshiva. The difference between, in his mind, the Rosh Yeshiva role and the community rabbi role was very simple, that a community rabbi is clearly someone who's getting a lot of honor, and clearly was a different time. He was clearly someone who was appreciated and loved by the community, and he didn't want all of that for himself. So as a result, he said, maybe I'll stick with the Rosh Yeshiva role, which someone, that individual is honored as well, but he saw it as being an incredible teacher of Torah, and that's what he ultimately wanted to do. So he taught Torah, and that was sort of his happy place. So that was in 1865. He was appointed as Rosh Yeshiva. I'm going to butcher this word, in Vasilishka. I don't know what that is. Some province in Vilna. That's where he was appointed as Rosh Yeshiva. He would serve as the Rosh Yeshiva there until the year 1869. This experience serving in this rabbinic role as a Rosh Yeshiva really seemed to inspire the Chavetz Chaim to want to continue work like this. Not there was ever really a doubt that he wanted to do it, but it was sort of convincing him that even though he maybe at times was uncomfortable receiving some sort of a stipend or money for doing this kind of a work, that this was clearly the role that he wanted to have in his life. So 4 years later, he went back to the city of Radin, where he was from, where he would live the rest of his life, and he founded a yeshiva there. That yeshiva started off very small, but it became bigger and bigger and grew to have several hundreds of students until really the end of the Chavetz Chaim's life. We'll speak about what happened to the yeshiva. So it was a very successful yeshiva. While he was the Rosh Yeshiva there, so he was known for his care for every single student. The way the story goes is that he saw a new student come to town, and that student, very excited to learn Torah, he dropped all his bags in a room somewhere, and then he just went straight to the Beis Medrash. And the Chavetz Chaim, seeing this, realizing this young boy had not eaten yet, he brought a pot of food from his house to the young man, and the young man, so immersed in his Torah learning, didn't even notice the Chavetz Chaim. And the way the story goes is that he stood there for a long period of time until finally he greeted him. He said Shalom Aleichem to the young boy, and he gave him some food. The Chavetz Chaim was known for always telling boys to leave the Beis Medrash when it was getting too late at night. If it was after midnight, he'd say go home, he'd go to sleep. The reason why this was the case supposedly was that when he was in yeshiva, he got very sick at one point, and he realized the importance of physical health, right? This is not usually something that we're used to hearing from a Gadol Hador. We're used to hearing like, no, you push yourself, you keep, right, you die over it, and he believed in that. It's certainly not that he didn't believe in, it's not that he did not believe in really pushing yourself to learn Torah, but he also believed in caring for yourself physically, and that if you don't do that, then ultimately you will learn less Torah. That was his perspective, and that was from a personal life event. Again, not such a common perspective that you would usually hear from the great Gedolim of yesteryear. Finally, by the year of the years of 1871 to 1873, that's when he wrote and published the book that would give him his namesake. He called the book Chafetz Chaim. That's how he became known as the Chafetz Chaim. The book of Chavetz Chaim is all about various laws of Lashon Hara. So that's how he became who he was. He was known, he had the reputation of not speaking Lashon Hara, I'm not really being too into Lashon Hara. And one of the well-known perspectives that he took about this book that he published was that he didn't want anyone to know that he wrote it. The reason why is because he's like, who am I? I'm just this nothing person. And so he didn't put his name there. He just named the book Chavetz Chaim. He went around selling his book firsthand. He didn't give it over to people to sell. He personally went around the surrounding communities to sell his book. He got incredible haskamot from a very big rabbanim. And before long, it was not too long that people understood that Chavetz Chaim, or the Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen Kagan, was the one who wrote this book, Chavetz Chaim. They connected the two, and they started calling him the Chavetz Chaim. Long story short, he became a very well-respected gadol in a very short period of time. It's really, I can't stress this enough, it's hard to capture the humility and the kindness that this man seemed to embody. It's not something that you always hear applauded as much as it should be. And you know, you'll hear and read in all these biographies that you see of all the gedolim, they're hasmad in Torah. And again, we value that. That's the most important thing. But to have someone who is genuinely so kind and so warm is not so common. And I don't know how to give it over any other way than just saying it blatantly like that. As the years went on, the Chafetz Chaim would go to publish many more Sfarim. I think by the end of his life, he published around 20 Sfarim. In 1876, he published Shmiras HaLashon, also related to various laws of Lashon Hara, but more from like an agadic kind of story-based point of view. In 1881, he published a sefer called Machane Yisrael. It was a concern that he had as he began to become more well-known, and I think therefore probably also sensitive to the larger, more national and international Jewish community. He saw that there were young Jewish Russian boys who were being drafted into the army. And he said, how could it be that these young Jewish boys are being drafted into the army? They barely know anything about Judaism. What are they going to do? So he wrote the Sefer Machane Yisrael for young Jewish soldiers who were being drafted so that they would be able to understand what the ideals of Judaism are and what they're all about, the fundamentals of faith that were necessary for every young Jewish boy to know. He would make sure that they got it through this book, which I believe was supposedly written in a very easy Hebrew. Right? You weren't supposed to be a big learner and read this book. It was for the simple guys who were drafted into the army that they had the opportunity to learn these fundamentals of faith. But it again shows how the Chafetz Chaim was just concerned about every single person. Finally, in 1883, that's when the Chafetz Chaim probably became most well known from our world point of view, and that is, what's the Chafetz Chaim most famous for writing? The Mishnah Berurah. So in 1883, he wrote his first volume of the Mishnah Berurah. His concern was that not only was he just a kind, gentle person, but that people just had no way to understand and grasp the entirety of the halakha corpus that we have in Judaism. So he said, I need to find a way to make the halakha understandable and attainable. So he sought out to write a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, specifically on Orach Chaim, which is all of the laws of daily living. And he said, I'm going to write a commentary that will be all-encompassing, that people could look at and just walk away and say, this is what the halakha is in this circumstance. And that's really what he did. And it's a pretty remarkable commentary for anyone who has ever learned parts of it, or even the entirety of it at large. It's amazing. He quotes sources from all over the place, and he always tells you basically what you're supposed to do. The one negative that people do say about it is that even though there's always a spectrum of leniencies and stringencies, so some people criticize him for being too stringent. There were earlier Sfarim, the Chaye Adam notably, had more lenient approaches. So I think Rav Schechter in YU is quoted as saying that we don't always pass like the Mishnah Berurah. There are times we pass like the Chaye Adam and other more lenient poskim, because who says the Mishnah Berurah needs to be the be-all and end-all of the Psak? But that was his goal, to make the Torah and the Halacha more attainable and more palatable for every single person. And if you read through the Mishnah Berurah, it's a relatively easy Hebrew. If you have just a peripheral understanding of how to read Hebrew a little bit, you can really make it through pretty easily. But that was his goal, to make it attainable for every single person. I apologize, because we don't have too much time, I'm not going to spend really much time on the sources, but I'll just tell you what some of these sources are. So in source number 2, it's the Hebrew and English partial translation of the introduction to the Chafetz Chaim's Sefer, Chafetz Chaim, on Lashon Hara, and he basically explains why it's so critical, why everyone should be guarding their mouths and speaking, not speaking badly about other people. Source number 3 is the introduction to his Mishnah Berurah. This is the full introduction, I believe. No, that's not true. It's partial. It's a part of the introduction. I apologize. I could not find an English translation online. But basically, he explains why it was so critical for him to write that book as well. That's usually what an introduction is. It tells you why it's so important to write a book like this. But let's keep going a little bit further. In the year 1886, that's when his youngest son from his first wife, Avraham, was 23, and he passed away that year. The Chafetz Chaim was known to have been very impacted by this loss of a son, understandably so. But it was difficult for him, or I guess probably not difficult for him, but I would say difficult for us, us to really see that grief, right? There was no real way for that to be shown so many years later, except for, take a look at source number 5. He heard that an old friend of his, an old acquaintance of his, Rabbi Chaim Leib HaKohen of Titkin, lost his son also. And he wrote the most beautiful letter. Again, I'm not going to read it inside right now, but take a look at source number 5 in your own time. And it's this beautiful letter that he wrote to his old friend who also lost a child. And you just see the compassion and the deep ability to empathize, right? Many people in the world who are somewhat human can sympathize. They can say, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. But he could empathize. He would feel the pain with people, which was just such a powerful quality that he had. True, he went through it, and that's why he was able to empathize on an even deeper level. But that's one of the examples of what made him so very special. Okay, as we go further, so in the year 1894, he published another sefer of his, was called Nidchei Yisrael, sort of another book to give the elementary fundamental principles of Judaism. He was specifically publishing this because he had gotten word that due to the rise of anti-Semitism, many Jews were traveling to America making, not Aliyah, Yerida, I don't know, they were moving to the land of the free, the home of the brave. And one of the well-known things about early Jews in America was that it was incredibly difficult to be religious, and as such, he saw it as part of his responsibility to help these Jews stay connected. So he wrote this book, like he wrote the book for the soldiers, the Russian, young Russian soldiers. So he also wrote this book for the Jews who are going to live in America to help them keep their connection to Judaism. He wrote this book to enable them to still feel connected and make sure they still knew what was what in Judaism. And 1899, we see another shift in passion for the Chavetz Chaim. Not just a concern for every single Jew, not just a concern that everyone should know halacha and have a basic understanding of it, but also an incredible desire for the geula, for the redemption. He always lived his life with the anticipation that, God willing, the geula, the redemption, would come very soon, the Beis HaMikdash would come very soon, and as a Kohen, he took this very personally. He said, what's going to happen? Who's going to serve in the Beis HaMikdash? We don't know any of the halachos. Who knows how to bring a karban? All right, so what are you going to do? So it was at that time when he decided to say, okay, I'm going to start compiling some halachos for bringing karbanos. So he, in 1899, he wrote the Likutei Halachos, in which he compiles an entire corpus of halachos of karbanos and how to bring them and what that would all look like when that would hopefully come once again very soon. In the 1900s, he had become more and more well known and sought after serve a more prominent position, right? So he said he was the Rosh Yeshiva in this Yeshiva Radin for many years. And again, this was a small city, so it was a relatively small yeshiva. So people said, come, Yisrael Meir, come become the rabbi of a more important yeshiva, of a bigger town. But he kept denying to leave his small little town and to leave his relatively small yeshiva, because this was his community, and that's what he was committed to. It's a tremendous Musar Haskil. Just he could have taken any position he wanted in the entire world, but he was just committed to this small town where he was born and bred, and he wants, or at least he was raised a little bit, and he wanted to just continue to help them as much as possible. But again, he continued to have this national or international perspective, looking out for Jews all over the world, doing whatever he could to support them. In 1903, his first wife passed away, so then 2 years later, in 1905, he marries again. I believe his first wife's name was Frida or Freda. His second wife's name was Miriam Frida. So I'm not sure if that's just like a mistake historically, or if it happens to be that they both had very similar names. But whatever it is, so he got married again a second time in 1905. He had two children with this woman. One of the children's names was Aaron HaKohen, kind of a great name. Interesting to note that he also had a son-in-law, Aaron HaKohen. People got confused historically. So there were two descendants, as it were, that came from the Chavetz Chaim that had the name Aaron HaKohen, his son-in-law, who was married to I think his daughter, his youngest daughter from his first wife, and then he had a son named Aaron HaKohen from his second wife. He then had another daughter as well, Fega Chaya. So Fega Chaya is probably most well known in our communities, in the greater YU community, because of who she married. She married an individual by the name of Rav Mendel Zaks, if anyone's ever heard of the name Zaks. It's one of the names that you would often hear most frequently in the YU based medrash. Like a number of my Rabbam would quote Rav Mendel Zaks and talk about him, and So the Zach's family that was his son-in-law, and that's how it became probably more well-known in our community as well. In 1911... he published another sefer on the laws of sacrifices and the like, called a commentary. So we know that many of the books of the Torah have a specific halachic medrash that goes along with them. So Vayikra has Torahs Kohanim, some of the laws associated with bringing sacrifices. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote a commentary to that. In 1914, tragically, World War I breaks out, as we unfortunately know, and it was a serious blow to the Russian Jewish community and many of the Jewish communities, Radin in particular, was impacted. And a lot of the dreams that I think were associated with what could become of this very special yeshiva of the Chafetz Chaim kind of began to crumble a little bit. It was pretty tragic. So the Chafetz Chaim was also found on several occasions sleeping in very uncomfortable ways throughout the times of this war. And one particular story they tell was that his wife found him sleeping. Again, he was pretty old. He was born in 1839, so by the time he's pretty old. Okay. All right, he was getting on. All right, whatever. It was 1914. So his wife found him sleeping on like this rickety old wooden bench. He didn't have a pillow. He didn't have a blanket. He was just sleeping on this bench. And she woke him up in the middle of the night. "What are you doing on this bench?" He said, "So many of our brothers and sisters in the entire world are suffering, and I'm going to sleep in." I'm sure he didn't have the most comfortable bed. I'm sure he wasn't like a Tempur-Pedic bed, but whatever that was, his bed was more comfortable than the bench. And she said, "What are you doing?" And he said, I can't be somewhat comfortable when so many people are suffering. Again, just this deep ability to empathize and connect with the pain of other people. In 1921, Rav Hirsch Levinson, who we had mentioned earlier, was a son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim, who he was very close to. He passed away, and this was also known to be another serious blow of the Chafetz Chaim's outlook on life, and it was very difficult for the Chafetz Chaim to move on from this. He once said that when he died, it was as if half of his body was stilled, as if half of his being was gone, so that we could understand how close he was with the son-in-law. This was also the year, 1921, that the Chafetz Chaim was forced to leave Radin because of the terrible anti-Semitism and the things going on with the war. So he would leave and then come back a few years later. In 1922 to 23, the Jewish year 5683, that was the 50th anniversary of his book, The Chafetz Chaim. And again, this was an incredibly humble man, but he was always writing books that he thought were practical. So the Chafetz Chaim was his first book that was meant to be a practical way for people to connect and understand some of the laws of Lashon Hara. So he had a big celebration in that 50th anniversary of the book, not because of the greatness that it led to him being noticed, but because it was this proliferation of these laws and this recognition of, okay, Lashon Hara maybe is something that we should work on. And to this day, right, many people, even though we're not unfortunately all masters in Lashon and not speaking Lashon Hara, I speak for myself, but I know other people probably resonate with that as well. But the notion of who the Chafetz Chaim was, that he stood for not speaking Lashon Hara, and his Sfarim that are still on many people's bookcases to this day speaks to how successful his mission was of bringing the importance of not speaking Lashon Hara to the forefront. But you still have people nowadays that do their best to say, "I'm going to try not to speak Lashon Hara from 2 to 3 in the morning," or whatever it is. People try their best to limit it as much as possible, just so. And this all comes from this mission that the Chafetz Chaim had. In 1923, there was the first great assembly of the Agudas Yisrael, and the Chafetz Chaim was asked to open the meeting of the Rabbanim that took place in Vienna. We'll see source 6 in just a second, but the story goes there as well, that he could not understand. This was the Agudas Yisrael had all the big Rabbanim in Europe, and he couldn't understand why he was asked to give the opening speech. But when he spoke, there wasn't a single person who didn't respect him, wasn't a single person who didn't value what he had to say. He was actually unique. There was a major shift in Jewish history at this time. Right? So there was always factions, there was always disagreements, but usually there was a pretty understood individual who was the gadol of the Jewish world at a given time. We've gotten, unfortunately, I think probably worse at that since the early 1900s, but the Chafetz Chaim was probably one of the last unequivocally across the board agreed and sought after gadolim in the Gadol world and in the regular Jewish world at large, such that when he spoke, again, he didn't understand it, but everyone understood why he was speaking, and he gave some speech, and I believe the quote that he had in the speech, is it here? No, I don't think it's here, so I'll just tell it to you outside. The speech that he gave was that, he said, I don't understand why I was chosen to speak here. He said, it happens to be that I am a Kohen, and I'm the oldest man here. So he says, it must be that I'm asked to speak because I am the eldest of Kohanim, not honors that I myself have worked on my own, but that God just gave me. I'm old and I am a Kohen, so okay, good. So he says, as a Kohen, I'm going to give the bracha to everyone. So he gives the Yivarecha, Hashem Yishmerecha, he gives the bracha of Kohuna to everyone, and he calls it a day. But he had no idea what he was doing up there. I mean, he knew what he was doing up there, but in terms of speaking, but he had no idea why he was asked to speak. But obviously he was respected and sought after by everyone. This was one of his big, major world stage moments, and there were various articles that were actually written up about it. Take a look at source number 6 from 10 lines into it. In the Jewish Daily Forward, a secular socialist newspaper published in New York, their reporter filed the following excerpt from Vienna on September 23, 1923. The rabbi of Sokolov, in the middle of his address, suddenly becomes silent. His hand remains outstretched in his gesture as if frozen. The audience, the presidium, the journalists, the visitors, and the galleries rise up all at once. Distinguished rabbis, devout and pious Jews, all get up from their places. A restrained, soundless agitation begins, a murmur of reverence and awe. The strident outcries of several ushers are heard. Make room, make way there. A passageway is quickly cleared. People press in on one another with bated breath, with a tremor in their hearts. They step back. Two rows of people form in the middle of the conference hall. Two rows of rabbinic delegates in elegant dress coats with long white beards. And between these two rows of rabbis, several other rabbis come leading. No, not leading. They come carrying other hands. A small, feeble old man, aged and bent, with a short white beard and a plain, worn-out black coat with a black scarf around his neck. When you see this tiny 90-year-old man for the first time, it makes a singular impression on you. You feel a quiver of awe and love in your heart, a tremendous reverence and respect beyond any limit. So this is obviously talking about the Chafetz Chaim, and this was his response by how all the Rabbanim greeted him. But again, this is written by a secular paper. So to realize that everyone had this awe for him, not just the great Gadolim of the time, but even the secular Jews of the time, everyone understood that this was someone very special, someone really beyond this world. As the next few years came, so the Chafetz Chaim aged on, and he began to pull back a little bit from some of his public roles because he was just too weak to continue. In 1933, the Chafetz Chaim passed away. There's a big dispute at what age he passed away. We said at the beginning that he was born in 1839, but there seemed to have been an argument between his family and historical records. His family, if you take a look real quick, it's source number 8. So the New York Times obituary, again, just to note that the New York Times have printed this because it was such a significant loss for the entire world. So the Chafetz Chaim, 105, is dead in Poland. So again, according to black and white historical records, it seemed like he was 95, not 105 when he passed away. But according to the family and evidently the New York Times, he was 105 when he passed away. Whatever it was, he was a relatively elderly man. Certainly. Sorry, especially for that time, for the early 1900s. I found what it said on his tombstone to be really, really amazing. If you take a look at source number 7, I mean, all the Gadol, it's you could have a whole shiur on just what it says in the tombstones of all the Gadolim. Also, I think it is. I think it was just cleaned off. I think it's just taken care of. Yeah. So this is the tombstone. It says, Po Nikbar Harav Aaron ben Hagon HaChasid Shebekahuna, Marino Yisrael Meir HaKoin Meiradin. And then it says he's the author of the Chavetz Chaim and the Mishnah Brura. V'od Sheniftar Pit'om. Bachuroso. I don't understand what it means. I assume it's like a... I'm not entirely sure, but it's saying that he was he died suddenly when he was just a young man. So I'm not entirely sure what that's about. But wait a second.
Can't be that if he died 105.
Wait a second.
He wasn't
sick. This might not be the right tombstone.
No.
No, but no, but it is no, because it's this Baal Mechaber Sefer Chavetz Chaim and Mishnah Brura.
Yeah.
All right, I'm not entirely sure what's going on over here, because Okay, fine. So let's backtrack for a second. I think that the tombstone is his tombstone because it says the author of the Chafetz Chaim and the Mishneh Berurah. I think that it's more of a point that he always had this young energy, as it were, to consistently be giving back. So maybe that's what it means that he dies.
Rav Aaron.
This is his
son-in-law
who did
die young. Thanks, guys. All right, I apologize. This is the tombstone for his son. I apologize. I'll continue. He was also great. All right, I'm sorry for that. So just to bring it back, I have 3 minutes left. So the Chafetz Chaim, he passed away at this old age of 95 or 105. There are so many amazing stories that are written about... Yeah, it was Sonia. Yeah, sorry, guys. There are so many amazing stories that are written about how the Chafetz Chaim viewed wills and how he thought people should leave their money at the end of their lives. There's one story in particular that I'll share very quickly, and that is that someone wrote up a will while they were still alive, and obviously, and they said, "Can you look it over, Rebbe, just to make sure it looks okay to you?" And it said it was giving this money to his wife, this money to his children, whatever. And he looks at it at the end and he says, "Well, where is the money for the Torah institutions? Where is the money for people who are less fortunate, whatever?" And it was always very clear that the Chafetz Chaim, again, believe that everyone should be contributing in whatever way they can to all facets of society, not just to your family. Don't just leave money to your family, but leave money to lots of other people and to leave money to those who need it the most. So the Chafetz Chaim, his will was actually found, and it's interesting to look through that. Again, not much time right now. We'll see one last source, I think, and with this we'll conclude. So, again, you go through the life of the Chafetz Chaim, which we did pretty quickly, and we see a few common themes. He was a very kind, loving, Torah giant, modest, humble individual, but there's not a single moment in which you're really able to understand when he is catapulted to the greatness that he attained. So how are we to wrap our heads around this? So take a look at Source number 9. It sort of speaks about this briefly. It says, "What was the secret of the Chafetz Chaim's unusual popularity and fame? He never offered surprising new concepts or formulated startling new theories." Right? He didn't usually publish Chidushei Torah. He just sort of reprocessed what was already out there and made it more palpable. More palatable. But he did brilliantly reanimate and illumine the ancient treasures of Torah. More than that, while other great men of Torah may have created new systems of study or inspired new movements, they never won the love of the Jews and worldwide fame as did the modest Jewish householder from the little town of Radin. It is not sufficient to ascribe the reason only to his many published books or to his piety or to his acumen and knowledge in Torah. Other pious and learned men in his time had similar virtues on published scholarly books, some perhaps more weighty in scholarship, but the mark they made on the world was narrower, never the same as that of the Chafetz Chaim." Right, and if you think about it nowadays, probably the most well-known Jew of yesteryear is the Chafetz Chaim. Everyone knows the name the Chafetz Chaim. He's just a well-known, everyone knows that picture, which I believe they say wasn't actually his picture, but everyone knows that picture of him right, oh good, so that's the actual picture of him. Philip, you'd pass that around if you're okay with that. Yeah, it's the real picture. So a few years ago, I believe where this picture comes from, a few years ago, there was a video recording of the Chafetz Chaim that was found, and I think this picture was sort of taken from that scene. You see in the picture...
A video recording?
It was like one of the first video recordings in...
That was around?
Yeah, yeah.
A film.
All right, so anyways, to wrap up, though, so ultimately we see from this man, the Chafetz Chaim, and again, I apologize for having the wrong tombstone. That's when you what happens when you prepare a shiur at 4 in the morning.
What does Kohen stand for? Kohen Gadol? Is that
sounds right. I'm actually not sure.
What's that?
What does Kagan stand for?
Kagan? Kohen Gadol, something
like that. I'm not sure. But we'll figure it out after. Good question. So that's an interesting question. He did not really seem to have a main disciple that came from him. Even his descendants, it's not so clear who all of his descendants are, although he does seem to have a number of descendants, again, from the Zacks family and the like. Sorry?
His son wrote a book.
Right. Well, so the Chafetz Chaim, also a lot of his teachings were written by his son or sort of edited by his son. I think they even say, and I apologize if I'm quoting this wrong, but I think they even say that that the Mishneh Berurah was written by the Chafetz Chaim, and that the Torah was from him, but that he wasn't not necessarily the one who that it was edited by his children. And as a result, there are sometimes you find some inconsistencies that seem to be there because he wasn't the final person to put it to print. I think that is what they say. But anyways, I think that the lessons from who the Chafetz Chaim was and are very clear. Just to be someone who cares and loves for all people, but at the same time, that doesn't mean you have to compromise your religious acumen, your Torah acumen. You can be equally a great Torah giant and at the same time a great human, personable giant. And that's really who the Chafetz Chaim was. That's what we all, I think, can learn from him, take away from him. And with that, I wish everyone a beautiful day.
I know.